Following Podvic is a non-profit fan-based production. Death Note and related characters are owned by Tsugumi Oba, Takeshi Obata, Shueisha Incorporated, and Viz Media. Please support the official release. In the Library, written and read by Raven Etar. Part 1. Polar. It was a chilly, windy day in Winchester. Dark clouds hung low in the sky, threatening rain while the wind scuttled them across the countryside. Townsfolk stayed indoors, close to fireplaces and central heating systems, while those who had no choice but work outside finished their tasks quickly to escape the chill. About 5 miles out of town was a tall and sprawling building built of brick, with an old tower and an antique bell that still sang every hour of every day. It was set on its own little parcel of land, which was dedicated mostly to open fields and playgrounds. Occasionally there would be a small patch set aside for a vegetable garden or a greenhouse, or even little groves of trees. For the most part, though, the surrounding area was wide and open. All the locals knew about this building. They were also sure that they knew its purpose and what it contained, but they only knew a portion. It was known as the Whammy House, or Whammies, and it was an orphanage. The locals found it odd for just how few orphans were ever adopted. Despite the many hopeful couples that would come to find a child, the majority would be turned away for failing to meet Whammy's exacting standards. It seemed that when it came to their charges, Whammy's was more than willing to do the raising themselves rather than risk questionable parents, which was how any orphanage should conduct its business, but the likelihood of it happening? Fairly low. In that way, Whammy House was strange to those who watched from the outside. Another oddness was the children themselves. To some, any orphan would appear to be alien, but the ones at Whammy's were a special brand. The games they played could range from the everyday antics of soccer and tag to quiet huddles involving bits of paper and calculators. If anyone ever spoke to one of the children, they would most likely find themselves struggling to keep up with an 8-year-old's explanation of theoretical physics. Whenever the children were brought into town on visits, their oddness only seemed to increase while in contrast to their normal surroundings. It was best, in the minds of the locals, to give the Whammy House and its occupants a wide berth. What they didn't know, what was kept very carefully from anyone's knowledge, was that Whammy's housed a very special kind of orphan. They took in the most intelligent, intuitive, and driven children they could find with the express intent of nurturing those abilities to their full potential. There were children from all over the world, and most were never meant to leave Whammy's until they could do so on their own feet. All of this was done for the purpose of preparing a successor for the world's greatest detective, L. All of the children knew their situation, the reason they were there. It was Whammy's policy to have complete honesty with their charges. Some of the children strove to be the best, to become the next greatest detective, while others were content to be receiving such special treatment and education. Of those who fought to rise to the top, two rose higher than any others. Those two were polar opposites in every way, in appearance, in attitude, in habit, and in drive. The only thing they seemed to have in common were their intellects, which were high even for Whammies. On this particularly cold day at Whammy's, almost every child was safely sequestered inside, along with their caregivers, who were glad of a relatively peaceful day. On the third floor in the west wing, in an all-but-forgotten little library, sat a pale boy in white pajamas, stacking the books around him and playing with plastic robots. The books were being leaned together, tented and balanced just so to create something between a cityscape and a roller coaster. The robots populated the city of literature, or invaded it, or fought each other within it, all at the boy's whim. The boy's name was Nier, and he was Whammy's top student, the child most likely to inherit the title of World's Greatest. It was his habit to spend his days alone, playing with his toys and building structures out of whatever was available. Dice, cups, dominoes, cards. He had a talent for stacking and balancing anything until his creations reached monstrous proportions. He wasn't a very active boy. In fact, he never participated in physical games the other children of Whammy's played, so he filled his days with quiet, solitary pastimes. It was a way to keep his hands busy, and something superficial to occupy part of his mind, freeing the rest to think on what it would. He supposed that was why the children had come to avoid him. Near never offered anything in the way of interaction himself, and was never interested when invited to their games. Antisocial by nature, it wasn't surprising the others had been had taken to ignoring the small albino. Not that he minded particularly. The others were all monotonous to him. They were all children, including Near, but there was not one spark of interest in any of them. A slim volume of poetry was leaned against a primer of algebra. In a strange way, Near was disappointed by his current situation at Whammy's. It was true he was well taken care of, very much so, and his particular quirks of personality were catered to an admirable degree, but he found that a good portion of his time was spent dissatisfied or frustrated. No one would ever know it to look at him. Near was quite proud of his poker faces, his emotionless facade, and held it strictly in place at all times. But despite that, he was dissatisfied. Not with the fact that he was never included in games or held in higher esteem by his peers. If anything, he held his fellows in a kind of contempt. No, he was disappointed by the fact that there was no one at Whammy's that could hold his attention or interest. He had long since come to terms with the idea that until he finally fulfilled his purpose and became a detective, there would never be enough to fully engage his mind. Even the grueling curriculum they enforced at Whammy's wasn't enough for Near. Nevertheless, he immersed himself in the material, and then found secondary activities to take up any slack. But he would have liked someone to talk to, someone whose intellect was on a par with his own, so that any back and forth wouldn't be entirely one-sided. As much of a recluse as he was, Near wasn't entirely immune from the desire for human interaction. As things stood now, though, there were only two people Near would classify as being worth his time and effort. A book of Nietzsche met a figure drawing manual in an A-frame. One of those people was L himself, a man he had never met and had only heard speak once through a voice scrambler on a computer. The man every child at Whammy's worked so hard to emulate, the man who solved the world's toughest cases without ever showing his face. Such a man that could be considered worth the effort of a full conversation. But the likelihood of ever speaking to L, let alone ever meeting him, was right about nil. It would probably be years before he even heard the man's altered voice again. The other one was actually another orphan at Whammy's, a very active boy, almost 2 years older than Near, and considered to be number two at the orphanage, although barely. Like Near and every other child at Whammy's, he went by an alias. He was called Mello. Blonde, athletic, somewhat feminine, extremely hot-headed, and capable of consuming enough chocolate in one day to make the fictional Willy Wonka sit up and take notice, Mello came right after Near in the line of succession, which was at least half the reason that the two of them didn't get along. Mello seemed to see Near's position of number one as a personal insult, and worked himself into a frenzy to beat the younger boy in any way possible, to prove himself the most deserving candidate. Near had found it amusing at the beginning, and then intriguing that anyone would push themselves to such limits. Did the blonde want the title of L so badly, or was it just the challenge to be the best? Was there some underlying reason for his drive to be seen as better, smarter, and best liked out of all others? Near didn't know, nor was there any realistic way to find out for himself. Every child's life prior to Whammy's was kept strictly confidential by the staff, and Mello would never answer any question Near might put to him directly. He would see it as an attack. In Mello's quest to beat Near, he had come to hate the younger boy for his constant ability to come out on top. This hatred had also interested Near for a time. It was an emotion that he did not have much experience with, and which he did not reciprocate. For Mello, it manifested in different ways, from pulling long night sessions of studying, to pointedly ignoring Near, to knocking down his carefully constructed towers, to taunting and teasing him in front of others. A few times, it had even escalated to physical violence. The first time that had happened, the first time Near was struck by him, Mello's antics had gone from interesting to sad. All of Mello's frustrations seemed to stem from a simple, if rather large, inferiority complex. While it was unknown to Near how he had first acquired it, its expressions became repetitive and predictable. Thus the second and last person Nir would consider a worthy person to converse with was taken off the list. One who might as well be a ghost, the other someone who would punch him as soon as look at him. Anyone else was simply not worth the air. Nir continued to build his sweeping metropolis of printed word in silence. On a cold day like today, even with all the children cooped up inside, everyone was quiet. There was a storm coming. It could be felt in the air, and the youth of Whammies were uncharacteristically subdued. Eventually, Nir's creation took up the entire floor and most of the tables. He stood carefully and surveyed his kingdom. After a moment of contemplation, he decided it was severely underpopulated, and picked his way through the books to fetch more toys from his room on the second floor of the east wing. For a while, the room was still, made even quieter by the absence of the little genius's breathing. Towers and monuments of text stood in defiance of the brightly colored robots locked in deadly battle. But without the boy who built them, played with them, and imbued them with life, they just seemed to wait. If they did wait, if books and toys are capable of waiting, they didn't wait long. A few minutes after the albino boy in white pajamas left the room, a lean blonde all in black entered. He stopped in the doorway and looked over the miniature skyscrapers and robots laid out before him. It was an impressive sight, but the blonde took it in quickly before shouting into the silence. "Nir, you little freak! Are you in here?" The books did not respond, and the toys only stared back with empty eyes. The boy, Mello, snorted and stepped inside gingerly, avoiding the stacked books, and closed the door behind him. If Nir had been in the room, he would have responded to Mello's shout. The runt was never afraid of him, despite many reasons to be. The last time Mello had caught the younger boy alone, he had come away with a black eye and a bloody nose. The bruise had lasted quite a while. For weeks it had been the only color to be found on the boy. But Nir never avoided him, never showed any concern for his own safety. Mello stepped around a particularly tall, corkscrewing tower made up of classics. The reason he was here, in fact, was to hunt Nir down and use him for stress relief. The weather had him out of sorts. Even sneaking outside and taking advantage of an empty courtyard hadn't made him feel better. Neither had hanging out with his best friend Matt, who was so engrossed in his new game that the only kind of weather likely to get his attention would be a tornado. So, with physical activity and hanging out with his friend both failing, all that was left was to pick a fight with Nir. Except the white mutant wasn't in his bedroom, his usual playrooms, or any of the quiet corners he liked to hide in. As Mello had searched, he had only become more and more irritated, and now, if he found his little rival, he might give him another black eye just out of spite. Mello passed a small arch of poetry, a pair of transformers rustling beneath it. He had obviously found where Nir had most recently been, so all he had to do now was wait for him to come back. Mello recognized some of the toys scattered around as being from Nir's personal collection, and he never left those lying around. Mello absentmindedly took out a bar of chocolate from his pocket and began to nibble on it. There was one robot in particular he recognized, a small red and white with a clear plastic dome over its head. It was one that Nir had had for years. It was carried around almost constantly by the albino and had a special place on the nightstand by his bed. Mello happened to know that little detail from the few times he had snuck into the boy's room while its occupant had been playing elsewhere. Mello had told himself at the time that he had been searching through to find the secret to Nir, his methods of study, the pastimes he didn't allow others to see, the stash of super-advanced textbooks that had his scores constantly outstripping Mello's, but it had just been curiosity. He could admit that now, at least to himself. There had to be something more to the Whammy's top student than met the eye, Mello reasoned. There had to be more than quiet games, silent study, and a face about as expressive as the dominoes he played with. Seriously, the kid was always by himself, playing some game or putting together blank puzzles. How were his scores so good? But no. His room always proved to be as plain and uncomplicated as Nir himself. White walls, white furniture, white bedding, and white carpeting. The only color to be found were in his toys. As for books, there was only what was given out to every student, nothing especially advanced by their standards. Another sweep of books led up to one of the tables like a highway. Mello took a large bite of chocolate and let it melt slowly on his tongue as he walked carefully through the balanced masterpiece. It wasn't as though Mello didn't try to improve his scores. He would study for hours. He would eat healthy in combination with chocolate. He got plenty of blood-pumping exercise, and he got plenty of sleep, at least most nights. There was no reason why he should be coming in second to Nier. None. Especially when the little freak of nature spent all of his time with useless projects like this one. What was the point in a city of books? Where was the mental stimulation that such a supposed genius would need? It was like Nier was taunting him, saying, "Look, I can outdo you in every way that counts, and I don't even need to work for it. Sucks to be you." Mello was tempted to knock over a series of A-frames, setting off a chain reaction and destroying Nier's book paradise at the thought of being mocked. Indirectly or not, in riddles or to his face, it made his blood boil and his palms itch to think about it. But he restrained himself, a rare occurrence for the explosive adolescent. He knew that Nier wasn't mocking him, in any way. To do so would involve some kind of personal, emotional connection with another person. Such things were beyond his unfeeling rival. Nier probably wouldn't care if Mello did outdo him one day, because that would also involve emotion. In a way, that annoyed Mello more than anything. If his opponent had been anyone, anyone else, there would have been some kind of interaction between them on a personal level, friendly or otherwise. Mello's shouting would be answered with something other than whispered responses. His challenges and threats met with more than a shrug. His punches replied with something more substantial than a pitying gaze. If the kid would just fight back, or actively run away even, that would be an improvement. But as it was, Mello felt like he was fighting air, where no resistance was offered. He was left fighting nothing but himself, and it was maddening. The chocoholic squatted down and read some of the titles on the books to see if Nier had incorporated some kind of scheme with subject matter as well as architecture. There was none that he could discern. He stood and continued to study his rival's work. What was most frustrating, Mello was only just coming to realize, was that his entire world was coming to revolve around Nier. The person he hated most in the entire world, his competition for the title of greatest detective. Almost every aspect of Mello's life was now wrapped around that tiny, frail frame. It had once revolved around L, to studying the predecessor and his methods, but not anymore. If Mello studied halfway through the night, it was to get a better score than Nier. If he took on an extra class, it was because Nier was doing the same thing, and he couldn't be allowed to know more than him. If Mello played sports especially hard, it was to have something Nier couldn't take away from him. Everything kept coming back to Nier, Nier, Nier. And it drove the blonde nuts. It was like the younger boy had achieved yet another victory by making himself the center of Mello's universe, by making all other considerations secondary to him, and all without trying, all without caring. As though Mello was nothing but a shadow. Something of no consequence, not even worth a glance as he was passed by, as Nier climbed ever higher. In another rare display of restraint, Mello managed to avoid knocking down the books by throwing his fury-driven fist into one of the bookshelves. No, he was worth consideration. He was second in line of succession, and that was far from nothing. Mello trembled as he tried to hem in the rage coursing through him. The chocolate bar he held had been crushed in a tightly balled fist. He could feel the tears of pure frustration forming in the corners of his eyes, and his belly ached as it cramped along with every other muscle in his body. If L was the best in the world, and his successors came right after him, that made Nier second, and Mello third. The third greatest in the world was worth more than a mere passing glance. He deserved more than to be thought of as just some kind of backup, a plan C, if both L and Nier somehow failed. Mello smiled a little. If Nier failed, if the little mutant slipped up, if he let himself slide just a bit, then Mello would be right there, ready to beat him at his own game. When L stepped down, and with Nier gone, Mello would... The boy's grin slowly faded, and his body seemed to sag into the bookcase. His shoulders came forward, and his head bowed, throwing strands of straight blonde hair into his blue eyes. He felt as though he had been drenched with ice-cold water, his inner fire effectively doused. If Nier was gone, finally beat by him, sick, or even dead, then what would become of Mello? Without his apathetic adversary, would he possess the same drive to be the best? With the little albino out of his life, would he still care enough to be great? Without the center of his universe, would he even have purpose? Mello let himself slide down to the floor. All of his energy was suddenly gone, and he hadn't even gotten to yell at Nier. Any irritation he had felt had just been sapped away. He didn't care. The despondent boy was in that position on the floor at the back of the library when the door was softly opened and in shuffled Nier. Mello froze. Now that his prey had finally come to him, he no longer wanted to pick a fight. But he couldn't be seen to be running away. Nier paused in the doorway, flat eyes looking into his makeshift playroom. Then, readjusting his grip on the armful of plastic toys he carried, he padded into the room in his white socks. Where Mello was sitting, he was concealed behind a couple of Nier's widest constructions, and Nier did not see him. The albino, once again carefully picking a path through the delicately balanced books, began setting out his robots, planes, cars, and whatever else he had managed to bring among the towers. Mello watched, keeping his breathing as slow and silent as possible, as Nier populated his city with toys. He knew he should leave. He should stand and walk out, knock down all he could on his way to the door, including Nier, and get back to his room where he could sulk in peace. But he didn't. He stayed put, as though clamped to the floor, and watched his hated enemy as he played his game. It felt a little strange to watch Nier this way. He had seen the boy play plenty of times, more often than not, in fact. But those had always been times where there had been others around, and he knew he was being watched. Somehow, this was different. Not just the thrill of being secretive, although Mello would admit to a little of that. No, Nier himself seemed subtly different. More at ease, the outline of his pale frame appeared softer. Even his breathing seemed easier in Mello's ears. Did Nier hold himself to such restraints when others were around, Mello wondered? Did the perfect emotionless puzzle solver have to keep himself in check to appear so flawless? Was his image just that? An image he projected? A false self? It's an interesting notion. If he did, then Mello's knowledge of it was a tiny chink taken out of the albino's armor, a place where he could gain a handhold. But if it was true, then it also begged the question of why. Why did Nier feel the need to hold himself apart? Did Nier actually feel? Mello continued to watch his enemy, the center of his universe, as he moved around the room, setting out toys and occasionally adjusting the books with a feather touch. At first he worried about when Nier would make his way to the corner he was hiding in, but it became apparent that the boy was not interested in the very edges of his creation, but was concentrated on the center. So Mello watched, and Nier played. Minutes stretched on, gradually became an hour, and then two. Mello had managed to arrange himself into a more comfortable position without being heard, and was lying behind the wall of literature. Nier was lying down at this point, too, on his stomach, playing with his toys and twirling his hair. It was amazing how long the boy could remain fascinated with such a simple activity. It had begun raining about an hour ago, and the sound of it beating against the old building was beginning to lull the older boy into sleep. He fought it, but combined with a fairly warm room, the smell of old books, and Nier's less than stimulating activities, it was working to overtake him. He wondered why it was, as he finally succumbed to slumber, that he hadn't been annoyed at being stuck in a room for so long with nothing to do but watch his arch-rival play pointless games. Normally, he hated to even be in close proximity with Nier, but not this time. Except for the first thought of escape, Mello hadn't had any motivation to leave the library that was Nier's private sanctuary. It had even proved relaxing to the consistently high-strung boy. It made no sense, and needed to be thought out carefully. Later. Nier looked up when the sound of soft snores came drifting out from the back of the library. Untangling himself from his nest of toys, he stood and made his way to Mello's corner and looked over the stacks that had concealed him. Mello was curled up on one side, facing out so he could watch Nier, the remains of a chocolate bar in one hand, the evidence that he had been eating it at one corner of his mouth. The black clothes were rumpled, his feet were bare and dirty, and his rosary had gathered into a small knot of red and black beads at his throat. Nier permitted himself the tiniest ghost of a smile. Mella made such a poor spy. But that wasn't surprising in light of his personality and passionate nature. The boy was intelligent, there was no denying, but was just not built for anything that required a great amount of patience. In fact, it was unusual Mella had even stayed as quiet as he had for so long. Almost as soon as Nier had re-entered the library, he had known that Mella was there. The smell of the older boy's chocolate was strong and unmistakable, and a tiny piece of wrapper had fallen on the floor had settled the issue. The question of whether he had still been in the room had been answered by muted noises of breathing and shifting that had come from his hiding place. Curious as to what Mella wanted, but not willing to show it, Nier acted as though he knew nothing of his presence and continued with his project. Knowing Mello, it would only be a matter of time before he came charging out, demanding something or other, or berating him for a recent test score. But he never did. It was odd. And Nier didn't think Mello's spying had anything to do with planned revenge, either. It was all too haphazard for that. It was all very strange, very out of character for Mello, the fiery, impulsive boy. Even more so was falling asleep in the presence of his enemy. It was true that Mello had nothing whatever to fear from Nier. Even if the younger boy wished to cause him harm, he wasn't exactly best suited to carry it out. But Mello would still perceive a threat. To fall asleep was a definite breach of character. It would require some thought. Carefully, Nier reached down over the books and caught a lock of yellow hair that had fallen across Mello's face. He wound it loosely around one finger, as he often did with his own white mane, before tucking it gently behind one ear. Silly Mello. Nier turned away from the dozing blonde and looked around the room, considering his options. Deciding, he moved around the room as silently as his socked feet would allow him, gathering together his personal toys to return to his room. The rest could wait for later, for when Mello had woken and left again, as could the task of reshelving all of the books. Before he left, Nier left one of his own robots by the slumbering Mello. He doubted Mello would damage it, and he felt that some sign of gratitude was due for the peaceful afternoon. Slightly confusing, but peaceful. When Mello woke up, he would find a domed red and white robot watching over him. This has been In the Library, a Death Note fanfiction, Part 1. Background music was Snowdrop by Kevin MacLeod at incomptech.com. That's incomptech.com. Thanks for listening, guys.